is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, and we're coming to you Tuesday, April 18th, 2006. March 31st, 2006, edition of Science Magazine. The Journal of Science publishes a report of the U.S. National Institute of Health, Fogarty International Center. If a bird flu pandemic hits the United States, it may well start in California and spread across the country in just 2 weeks. Today on Taking Aim, Profit and Repression, the Politics of Pandemics. The spread of infection was studied by the Fogarty International Center of the National Institute of Health by a computer model, and it is based upon the data from ordinary flu epidemics for the last 3 decades. In other words, these are the pandemics of the avian flu variety, but not including the Spanish influenza of 1918, which killed 50 million people worldwide. This computer modeling is similar to computer modeling that we've discussed on Taking Aim, which is used to simulate military operations and also the control of populations. In other words, the National Institute of Health, by studying the flu epidemic or a potential flu epidemic, is going to analyze what it would do to quarantine areas or to ask for the government to institute forced evacuation. The Wall Street Journal, December 9th, 2005, looked at the flu pandemic from another angle, the angle of corporate profits. The flu pandemic could cost the U.S. economy $675 million. A pandemic caused by a mutated form of the avian flu virus could cause a $675 billion hit to the U.S. economy. This was the report of the Congressional Budget Office, another federal vehicle. Ralph?
Well, Maya, the Fogarty researchers' study are using epidemiological data on seasonal flu epidemics, as they describe them, that have occurred yearly since 1972. Yearly since 1972. And this data, which is derived from the Census Bureau and the Federal Department of Transportation, makes it very clear that these yearly episodes of epidemic are not unrelated to the manipulation of viruses that we've been describing over this series of broadcasts concerning the creation of the next pandemic. They look at a variation in each yearly epidemic from state to state. They link it with local flows of people to workplaces. They describe a process that has now involved as many as 45 countries from Africa, Asia, and Europe. And they are projecting not just ordinary epidemics, but pandemics that will require an entire apparatus of control of the population and an engine of profit that has been unprecedented even for the pharmaceutical industry.
It's interesting, Ralph, that they're using data from 1972, and the last flu pandemic was in 1968. So consequently, they're studying the flu mutations that are happening worldwide, and particularly they're looking at data from the United States, because this is the data that is most concerned to the corporate directors and also the U.S. military and the U.S. government and the U.S. government overall. As the Wall Street Journal reporting from the Congressional Budget Office stated, a mild pandemic would cut the U.S. gross domestic product by 1.5%, which might seem like a small percentage, but in fact is a big hit monetarily of $675 billion, because they estimate that the pandemic would affect one-third of the population. One-third of the population, because it's 30% of the workforce is ill or misses at least 3 weeks of work because they're either ill or they're too frightened to go to work. And also, you have to consider what happens when people are ill. Who manages the public transportation system? Who manages the communication systems, that is, the telephone systems, the internet systems? Who transports food cross-country? Who handles the cargo docks? Who handles all the aspects? Who teaches? Who manages all the aspects of daily life in the United States? Imagine one-third of the workforce becoming ill. Now, this is hypothetical. There is no evidence, and this is stated over and again when you read the reports of scientists. There is no evidence that a human pandemic is inevitable, and yet we have the World Health Organization, and we have in the United States the Center for Disease Control creating a furor, creating a drumbeat that there is going to be a pandemic. Not if, but not when, but if.
Not if, but when, Maya. But, and the pandemic that they that you were describing in the Wall Street Journal, a cut of the GDP by 1.5%, that involves the infection of 90 million people and at least 2 million dead. 1.5% drop, 2 million dead, 90 million people infected. And indeed, there is a drumbeat, as you call it, for a much more severe pandemic than that, with 2 million as considered to be a minimal impact. In the wake of this Wall Street Journal calculation about costs and the scale of pandemic, the following information is provided to us. Roche Pharmaceuticals, a unit of Roche Holdings, has reached agreements with drug companies Teva Pharmaceuticals and Mylan Labs to increase the production of Tamiflu. And indeed, the senator from New York, Charles Schumer, in a release said the company is expected to announce agreements with 13 other drug companies. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina announced in October that Roche has agreed to work with the United States government to sub-license the production of Tamiflu, an antiviral drug, on a vast scale. They are stockpiling it all over the country.
And we should say we're going to discuss the profiteering about Tamiflu and who's involved in that profiteering a little later in the program after we look at the overview of how corporate capital is looking at what they consider the impact of a pandemic. And it's interesting also to note that there is no evidence that Tamiflu, which is an antiviral that you have to take within the first few hours of contracting a virus, there is no evidence that it would have any impact on avian flu virus. But let's look at another aspect of the capitalist analyst, and this is Deloitte & Touche. So very big in terms of advertising, but also in terms of research and as consultants to many businesses worldwide. The New York Times published the results of their studies. Mark Layton, the global leader for enterprise risk services at Deloitte & Touche in New York. This was March 16, 2006. Is business ready for a flu pandemic? And as opposed to the CDC, which estimated 30% of employees could be sick at any one time, Deloitte & Touche, their survey estimated 40%. That means if you add the children of the employees, because if teachers are sick, how are the students going to go to school? So this is more than half of the population would be sick at one time or out of work. And this is, again, March 16, 2006 edition of the New York Times. As their report said, a pandemic flu outbreak in any part of the world would potentially cripple supply chains, dramatically reduce available labor pools. So they're not just looking at the United States. they're looking at the global commerce. What does it mean when you have outsourcing, when you have part of your production in India or part of your production in China? How does it get delivered if people there are sick? Not just people in the United States, but people in another part of the world. What is the impact on business then? Ralph?
Governments worldwide, the New York Times article of March 16th states, have spent billions planning for the influenza pandemic, buying medicines, running disaster drills, developing strategies for tighter control. One piece of the plan missing is the ability of corporations to continue to provide vital services. Airlines will have to fly health experts around the world. Overnight couriers will have to rush medical supplies to the front lines. Banks will need to ensure computer services continue to move money internationally. News outlets will have to keep broadcasting so people get information that may mean the difference between life and death. Listen to the magnitude of disaster that they are calmly and casually presenting in the beginning of this article on March 16th, as if this is a foregone conclusion, and the scale of total dislocation and total impact of mass disease and government control is a given.
Ralph, in this article, it mentions that when there was the SARS outbreak in Asia, and remember that the SARS outbreak is now known to evolve from laboratories in China. When this happened in Singapore, businesses required temperature checks before anyone entered a building. So they were screening people, much as the way we have now before you enter an airline. Today I was on a plane back to the Bay Area, and I was thinking about how years ago you went up to the counter, you showed them your ticket, and you got on an airline. Now, not only is it your identification, but you have to take off your jacket, you have to take off your shoes, you have to put all your belongings in a pack, in a box, and everyone is in a panic. And just as based upon looks, even though they say it's not based upon looks, on the plane I was entering, people with darker skin were set aside for more thorough searches. And this is what people are just accommodating themselves to, and that is exactly what's going on now with the flu pandemic scare. More and more accommodation of the population to repressive measures.
Business is not prepared for even a moderate avian flu epidemic, the report concludes. Now, by the way, with reference to the SARS phenomenon, Maya, we reported in our earlier show, with Mei Van Ho's discussion, it's not just laboratories in China. SARS was a completely contrived pandemic or potential pandemic. It was, in fact, a classic model of the laboratory-induced infection and the artificial spread thereof for a particular purpose. This is part of a long-term agenda of creating a pandemic for profit and for control, profit and for repression, profit and for manipulation of the public's capacity to function in a normal fashion so that the arbitrary and autocratic coercive power of the state cannot be challenged.
And Ralph, Yahoo News published an article on February 28th, prior to the New York Times article, by Maggie Fox, their health and science correspondent, who again, based upon 40% of the workforce being out sick with a flu pandemic, looked at what would happen to the other people in our society. And if a third of the people are out sick, she notes, another third will have to stay home to care for their relatives and the children who are out of school, and then still others will be afraid to come to work. Well, if you keep adding up a third, and then a third, you have most of the population homebound. And this is, as we've pointed out on other programs, such as developing the Model Health Emergency Acts, and also the simulations that are done, the computer modeling that are done in some of the universities where they're taking transportation models and using those to simulate the spread of a smallpox or another virus across the country, you can see how they are setting up the conditions for quarantining parts of the American population.
Encourage sick leave and flu pandemic, firms urge. That's the Reuters report that you're citing. 40% of the workforce is out when the flu pandemic strikes. Quote, the H5N1 influenza virus will spread throughout the United States and mutate into a form that easily infects people and will spread globally within weeks. Second paragraph of the Reuters dispatch. We have seen in the past several weeks a remarkable acceleration in the pandemic. In birds, Dr. Rajiv Venkaya, Special Assistant for Biodefense, President George W. Bush, declared, it is something short of inevitable that we will see H5N1 here in the United States, but very close to inevitable. Very close to inevitable. At the peak of the pandemic, each company must be prepared to sustain absenteeism of 40%, Venkaya told the conference sponsored by Trust for America's Health and Fleischmann Hilliard Public Relations. They already engineered the public relations accommodation of the mass of our people to the inevitability of such a pandemic.
Well, Ralph, the inevitability and how will they run government? This is something that they are simulating with simulations of different hypothetical events. And on March 19th, 2006, Newsday published an article by Associated Press writer Deb Reichman, which talked about a smallpox drill that was held at the White House complex. It's interesting, while the cabinet officials were there, the president was nowhere to be seen. The cabinet officials gathered at the White House complex on the Saturday before for a drill simulating a smallpox attack against the United States. Now, let us be clear, smallpox has been eliminated, and it was the president of the United States, this president of the United States, George Bush, who prevented the destruction of the last samples of smallpox that were being held by the government. And this is a disease that has been eliminated, but as we reported last week, is being simulated in labs, and also they're studying, they're creating a more virulent smallpox, one for which the smallpox vaccination that has been stockpiled in the United States wouldn't be effective. The four-hour exercise was supposedly to test the government's response plan. It was conducted by Health and Human Services Secretary Mike Leavitt, Agriculture Secretary Mike Johans, and Center for Disease Control Director Dr. Julie Gerberding. And remember, it's Dr. Julie Gerberding who is leading the charge on the pandemic scare. Yeah.
Well, Maya, we've reported and discussed the Sunshine Project called the Genetic Engineering of Smallpox, which documents the World Health Organization's retreat from the eradication of smallpox virus, and not merely that, but the United States retaining the smallpox virus and deploying it as a biological warfare agent. Smallpox killed one quarter or more of the population that it infects. It leaves many who do not die disfigured and blind. And the Sunshine study on the genetic engineering of smallpox makes abundantly clear that so far from eradicating smallpox, the United States is re-engineering a more virulent form of smallpox, deploying it as a bioweapon, and preserving it as an instrument of not merely war, but of affecting civilian populations in general. The creation of genetically engineered smallpox and hybrids of smallpox and other viruses pose serious public health, biosafety, the Sunshine Project describes. The pox viruses are not entirely species-specific, but the insertion of smallpox genes into these related pox viruses has created a specific and dangerous new human pathogen. Through genetic engineering and targeted mutations, These government labs are taking pieces of the smallpox genome and creating a novel virus with its characteristics that are without any known antidote, and that is by design. So the smallpox drill held at the White House complex in the light of the genetic engineering of smallpox is, in fact, a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Well, Ralph, let's look deeper into what the government has been planning for to counteract the hypothetical pandemic, the pandemic that we have been documenting for over a year is being created by the U.S. government itself. On November 1st, 2005, President George W. Bush spoke before the National Institute of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. It was a massive press conference, very high profile, more press than ever attend one of his press conferences. And he, at this National Institute of Health press conference, he was announcing, because I don't think it was actually prepared yet, a 381-page plan, which was officially called the Pandemic Influenza Strategic Plan. The president stated, quote, "Scientists and doctors cannot tell us where or when the next pandemic will strike or how severe it will be, but most agree at some point we are likely to face another pandemic, and the scientific community is increasingly concerned by a new influenza virus known as H5N1 or avian flu." But the speech is a model of how the U.S. government works hand-in-hand with corporate business and how it serves the interests of business. Because let's look. I did an analysis of this speech in terms of the capitalist financial approach to an avian flu influenza. And if we look at the speech, it shows $7.1 billion allocated, $1.2 billion for the Department of Health and Human Services to purchase enough doses of vaccine for 20 million people. Only 20 million people. And these are vaccines that have not been tested and for which no one knows whether or not they will work against an avian flu virus. And as been noted by the CDC, and as Ralph mentioned before, the avian flu virus is mutating rapidly. So the virus that you prepare a vaccine for today is nothing like the virus that might hit. Secondly, increase the stockpiles of Tamiflu and Relenza, which are antivirals. That's $1 billion. Three, $2.8 billion to accelerate the development of cell culture technology, instead of relying, he said, upon the 1950s technology, which utilized chicken eggs infected with an influenza virus. That's $2.8 billion. Now, four, remove the liability for vaccine manufacturers, which was done as part of the Homeland Security Act for the smallpox vaccine. Now President Bush is proposing that this be the case for all vaccines. Five, emergency plans, laws, such as the Model Health Emergency Act, which we've been reporting on for over 2 years, to be in all states and communities. $500 million to the states for pandemic preparedness. And the U.S. government has instituted a new website called www.pandemicflu.gov. This is an emergency funding request of $7.1 billion. At the same time of the $7.1 billion, the funding was cut drastically for social services. And everyone knows that the funding was expected to come from cuts in Medicare and other social spending. Ralph.
In a study by F. William Engdahl, bird flu, a corporate bonanza for the biotech industry, Tamiflu, Visteed, and the Pentagon agenda, Engdahl examines the following. Prominent among the president's list of emergency measures was a call for another $1 billion explicitly for Tamiflu. But the saga of Tamiflu is the tip of a big iceberg. The real point of interest is the company in California who developed Tamiflu, Gilead Sciences, listed on NASDAQ as GILD. U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld is chairman of the board of Gilead Sciences from 1997. He is on the board of Gilead since 1988, some 13 years. Rumsfeld purchased additional stock in his former company, Gilead Sciences, worth $18 million, making him one of the largest stockholders. And as the bird flu scare has heated up, Fortune magazine reports that Rumsfeld decided not to sell his shares of Gilead. And indeed, he was not merely hanging on, but in bagging what was called an eye-popping windfall, as demand for Tamiflu exploded worldwide under the direction of the White House demand through the allocation of $1 billion of funding for the manufacture of this vaccine. And the Pentagon announced it was stockpiling quantities of Tamiflu for all members of the military. The share value of Gilead Sciences has gone from $7 a share to $50 a share. And the future price direction is to be an even exponential increase of this, the stratosphere, especially since Bush made it an explicit goal of the U.S. Flu Defense Preemptive War, as it's called, is in fact a marketing plan for Hoffman La Roche, which gets 10% of every dose of Tamiflu sold.
Ralph, Gilead gets 10%. It's Hoffman La Roche that will be producing the...
Yes, that's quite right.
Because Hoffman La Roche has worldwide manufacturing capability.
But Gilead is going to be retaking 100% of marketing control as well. So you have here 720% profit for Rumsfeld's stock holdings since he went to Washington. The sheer kleptocracy, the corporate plunder that's involved in this engendering of a mass flu epidemic is transparent here.
And, Ralph, we have to repeat over and again that there is no evidence that Tamiflu will have any effectiveness against an avian flu influenza should there be a pandemic.
Now, Maya, Gilead Sciences is no small-time biotech startup. In fact, it was put into existence by friends in Washington in high places, and has a total market capitalization of $22 billion, and its board of directors includes Bechtel Corporation director and former Secretary of State George Shultz, and the Bechtel is right up there with Halliburton in terms of the securing of a lion's share of Pentagon sweetheart contracts for the rebuilding of Iraq. In fact, Shultz and Rumsfeld and the Bush crew are deeply involved in Carlyle, which we've discussed in relation to 9/11, since the Carlyle Corporation is the heir to the Bin Laden family enriching of the Bushes through Arbusto, the Bush Corporation, and Harkin Energy, which is an aspect of 9/11 that we've dealt with from the inception.
Ralph, it's not just the United States that's been stockpiling Tamiflu, as we've reported before. The United Kingdom, Tony Blair had ordered the government of the United Kingdom to purchase enough Tamiflu to supply 25%, one quarter of 56 million British of the 56 million British citizens. So the Great Britain has also been stockpiling Tamiflu, making the share prices go up.
Now, in the same relation to Tamiflu is the relation of Rumsfeld and the Pentagon to smallpox. Because Rumsfeld has ordered members of the armed forces to be inoculated against smallpox, an inoculation with horrendous side effects. And the Rumsfeld smallpox package, which includes the Pentagon stockpiling of a drug named Vistide, which is supposed to minimize the side effects of this smallpox infection. Now, Vistide is exactly
Vistide is a product of Gilead Mad Science is the very company we are talking about that has the proprietary information of Tamiflu. And
now, Maya, we understand why it is that they are reinventing the smallpox virus and mutating it and preserving it and then producing a so-called vaccine against it to market for profit.
And we will return to this subject after the station identification.
We're the New Orleans Jazz Vipers at WBAI, New York City.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Today we continue our Creating the Next Pandemic series with the politics of the pandemic.
From mass pandemic to mass profiteering and repression, the underlying politics of the pandemic scenario.
And Ralph, you were speaking about Vistid, the product of Gilead Sciences, which Donald Rumsfeld was a major director and shareholder, and for which is being used by the Pentagon now that he's Secretary of Defense. Dr. Kuritsky, who's the director of the National Immunization Program and the Early Smallpox Response and Planning at the Center of Disease Control, had said, "Smallpox has a slow transmission and is not highly contagious." He doesn't agree with the stockpiling of Vistud.
Vistid.
Go on, Ralph.
Well, Maya, what's particularly instructive of what Bud Kuritsky has exposed is that Mr. Rumsfeld's Vistid has a terrible consequence. As Dr. Kuritsky has established, the effects from this smallpox immunization include, quote, serious brain and heart disease, autism, abnormal chromosomal change, diabetes, cancers and leukemia, demyelination of nerve tissue as a direct consequence of the utilization of this so-called vaccine. And they're stockpiling hundreds of millions of doses of this Vistid at a huge profiteering for Rumsfeld and his crew, has the precise effects that Kuritsky has set forth. I repeat, brain and heart disease, autism, abnormal chromosomal change, diabetes, various cancers and leukemia, demyelination of nerve tissue. What are we describing here? A fiendish, Mengele-like infliction on the population of the consequences of the vaccine itself for nothing more than profit. And the smallpox terror scenario, fear-mongering, is directly related to the run-up to the February 2003 war in Iraq, because Rumsfeld were spreading the story that Saddam Hussein had stockpiled stolen Russian stocks of the smallpox virus and was going to unleash an attack on the American public. And in fact, in the 2003 State of the Union address, Bush proposed creating a Project BioShield to develop vaccines and drugs against the bioterror attack from Saddam Hussein involving anthrax and smallpox. The very smallpox that the government is through its laboratories is re-engendering, first deployed as a rationale for invading Iraq, now for the profiteering of Vistid. This is a criminal ruling class. This capitalist ruling class has put its foot on the path of mass murder of our own people for nothing more than profit and control and for engineering the architecture of the fascist state.
Ralph, let's look at another aspect of the profiteering with vaccination and also with the corporate structure of the food industry, because it is what they're saying is that avian flu is going to mutate from birds to humans, and this often happens through contact via pigs, through swine, who have both the genetic structure of the animals and also human beings. And an article from New Scientist, March 24, 2004, bird flu vaccination could lead to new strains. In it, you have to note that 100 million birds have been destroyed in anticipation of eliminating bird flu. When there is evidence in an area of avian flu, they destroy entire flocks within miles of that, of finding whether it's a wild bird or a bird in the poultry poultry flock. Vaccinating chickens may be the only way out, New Scientist says, of the bird flu nightmare. Now, this is their theme, not ours, in Asia. But it could also lead to the evolution of new strains. The latest research shows increasing the risk of a human pandemic. And what I want to look at about this article is not so much the evolution of the bird flu and the strains, but the notion of vaccinating all chickens. That means profits from the vaccination. And that is what they're putting forward now in Asia, where there had been not the same vaccinations as you have here in the United States. And even here in the United States, the poultry growers are beginning to vaccinate entire flocks. Ralph?
Yes, Maya. What you're raising about the essentially the destruction of other species, the hundreds of millions of birds that have been targeted for mass murder and elimination, part of a program of design. This is a sinister attempt to create a condition, first by targeting the other species and then by creating the conditions for inflicting on the human population both the consequences and the control. But before we address that specific question, I want to look at an aspect of what we've just talked about with respect to the smallpox scare that was begun 3 years ago with respect to the pending invasion of Iraq. Because it was that time, as we began to discuss last week, that they inserted a paragraph into the Homeland Security Bill that provides immunity for liability to all drug companies who manufacture the smallpox vaccine. So they're not immunizing us. They're immunizing the drug companies from the consequence of the vaccines that we're describing here that have these terrible consequences that Dr. Koritsky documented.
And, Ralph, it was in President Bush's press conference at the Center for Disease Control, which outlined the $7.1 billion proposed expense that he wants Congress to spread this immunity for the drug companies, not just for smallpox, but for all these medications.
Well, I want to look at this in a very specific historical context, because in essence, as you say, what the drug makers are now being allowed to do is to foist on the public Vistid, Tamiflu, or thalidomide without legal consequences. We have to think about the origins of this. Now, during the 1960s in Germany, Dr. Heinrich Muchter, an infamous Nazi doctor who was sought by the Polish government for his experiments using live typhus on concentration camp inmates, founded a drug company where he developed a drug he marketed as his harmless sleeping tablet. His product, Contergan, was advertised as so harmless that it could be sold over the counter, and 1 million Germans used it. The results were soon clear, with tens of thousands of grotesquely deformed births. The drug he developed contained thalidomide. And indeed, the huge scandal surrounding the antiarthritic drug Vioxx, which was used by more than 2 million people around the world, was produced by Merck & Company. Once again, Merck is one of the companies in which Donald Rumsfeld has an interest. Vioxx users had a 400% increase in heart attack and stroke. And the threat of litigation was a major factor leading Merck to pull Vioxx. Merck and Company began in Germany by selling products including morphine, codeine, quinine, and strychnine as medications. Indeed, the German aspirin inventor Bayer Company sold heroin labeled as a cough suppressant. And it was in precisely in relation to this corporate and drug company victimization of the population, culminating in the drug company's role in Nazi Germany, that led to the Nuremberg Code, which held the drug companies and pharmaceutical industry fully responsible for the consequences of this of these cynical infections of the population with their products. That's what this immunization for drug companies is designed to eliminate. We're dealing with the Nazification of the drug industry in the United States in pursuit of the great pandemic.
Well, it's the immunity. This is one of the major aspects that's happening with immunity for doctors. It's the Bush administration over and again is talking about the litigation and the lawyers, the problem of the lawyers, when in fact it is such litigation against the auto manufacturers, the famous book by Ralph Nader, Unsafe at Any Speed, and the issue of production of cars where that would, when they were rear-ended, people would, they would burst into flames. This is only comes out through this litigation. And now what the government wants is wholesale immunity for drugs that are not tested and for which there is no known effectiveness either.
And that puts into precise context the New Scientist article by Deborah McKenzie, bird flu vaccination leads to new strains, because it is, in fact, the vaccinations themselves that are related to the creation of new variants and strains of these viruses, which have what they call, are called here in the New Scientist article, unpredictable consequences, in which the varied virus which is induced is unstoppable, and indeed the vaccination is the cause and not the cure.
And Ralph, that leads us to a very important article by Wendy Orent. And Wendy Orent writes often about plague and pandemic. She's the author of Plague, The Mysterious Past and Terrifying Future of the World's Most Dangerous Disease. And this is an article that appeared originally in the Los Angeles Times, March 12th of this year, where it was entitled, The Price of Cheap Chicken is Bird Flu. In newspapers across the country, such as the Houston Chronicle, the title was Blame Big Chicken Farms for Bird Flu Threat. The lethal virus is a product of the industrial poultry trade. Yes, this is what Wendy Orent has found out, that the lethal virus is a product of the industrial poultry trade. And what we have shown is that through government manipulation, they create the pandemics. But what she has found out by discussing with Earl Brown, a University of Ottawa flu virologist who has studied the evolution of viruses, not just the avian flu, he states, lethal bird flu is entirely man-made. It first evolved in commercially produced poultry in Italy in 1878. The highly pathogenic strain H5N1 that we have seen appear in Asia, spread throughout Africa, and move on through Europe is descended from a strain that first appeared in Scotland in 1959. Now, we have to question how it moved from Scotland in 1959 to Asia. That's a very large geographic leap. She writes, people have been living with backyard flocks of poultry since the dawn of civilization, but it wasn't until poultry production became modernized and birds were raised in much large numbers and concentrations that a virulent bird flu evolved. When birds are packed close together, any breaks on virulence are off. Now, industrial poultry actually was launched in the 1950s by two Harvard Business School professors, Ray Goldberg and John Davis. And they're the ones who promoted concentrated, vertically integrated, multinational businesses, which they called agribusiness. And this agribusiness led to the industrial chicken raising of what we know for Purdue chickens and Foster Farm chickens. And companies such as CP Group, that's Sharon Popkin Hand Group, which in China has factory farms that raise 5 million birds at a time. And in Thailand and China, as well as in Indonesia, Cambodia, Vietnam, and Turkey, this company, CP Group, can exported 270 million chickens in 2003 alone. This is one company, one of these agribusiness companies alone, the horrible, horrendous slaughter of these creatures.
Well, Maya, let me emphasize what you cited from the virologist Earl Brown of the University of Ottawa. The lethal bird flu is entirely man-made. The lethal bird flu is entirely man-made. The poultry farming in China on the part of small peasant villagers and their small private poultry stock, there was no evidence of bird flu whatsoever. Poultry, in fact, represented the greatest wealth to these families. But indeed, the spread from Scotland to China is not merely a bizarre phenomenon. What is involved here is the factory farming of chickens that is the direct cause of the inducement of this virus amongst the poultry.
Well, Ralph, I think it probably was implanted from to China. I don't think this is an accident that
Asia. What you're describing here is precisely what the Center of Disease Control and the World Health Organization have been documented as doing with everything from AIDS to Ebola and Marburg, which is in the form of vaccinations and in the form of nominal health programs inducing these mutated viruses that have been developed in such labs as the Plum Island Lab, as we've described. And I think you're quite right about the process through which it jumps from Scotland to China. But the point, again, here with respect to the commercial poultry industry, which, as the virologist Earl Brown has stated, caused the catastrophe in the first place, is that the conglomerates are what are creating the spread of this virus amongst the poultry themselves. Artificially induced, it is then spread through this factory production of chickens, in which the birds are tormented, have no room in which to move, in which they're breathing and needing their own feces. The virus is, in fact, not merely induced in the first place, but spread through these factory conditions.
And then mutates. And what Wendy Orent notes is that the Southeast Asian country without any rampant bird flu is Laos, where 90% of the poultry production is still in peasant hands. And it's if we look at Nigeria, for instance, where the disease killed by February 10th, 100,000 birds, these were on factory farms, where they were first found, not in the peasant farms. Now, I just wanted to look at one thing, because there has been so much in the press that wild birds are the spreading, that they're the source of avian flu, and migratory birds are bringing avian flu throughout the world. And Richard Thomas of BirdLife International, a global alliance of conservation organizations, disputes this, as well as other people who study the migration of birds. And they dispute the idea that wild birds carried the flu virus from Shanghai, which is near Tibet, to Russia and beyond. And that's how it's been moving towards Europe. They point out that the disease spread from Shanghai to southern Siberia during the summer months when birds do not migrate, and that it moved east to west along railway lines, roads, and international boundaries, not along migratory flyways. This is very important. We have to debunk all the propaganda that is coming to us through the government and through the press.
Well, Maya, Wendy Orent, as you cited from Pittsburgh Tribune Review and the Los Angeles Times and the Houston Chronicle, chicken never has been cheaper. A whole one can be bought for little more than the price of a cup of coffee from Starbucks. But the industrial farming that make every cheaper chicken possible have created the lethal strain of bird flu virus H5N1 that threatens to set off a global pandemic, have created it. Now, what's revealing here is this. We have, in our broadcast on Vision of Hell, the unspeakable torment of other species, have constantly emphasized that the exploitation and the mass murder of animals is directly related to the exploitation and mass murder of human beings. You cannot draw a line between the treatment of living and feeling creatures and their use and abuse and think that it's going to stop short of the species barrier. When Malcolm X talked about the execution of John F. Kennedy's the chickens coming home to roost, ironically enough, what Malcolm was saying is you cannot have a murder apparatus parading the world and think it will stop at your national frontiers. Brothers and sisters, you cannot have a murder apparatus unleashed on all forms of life, on the exploitation and the mass extermination of living creatures, and think that will not reflect itself in the way we treat our own. There is a seamless relationship between the murder and exploitation of animals and the murder and exploitation of human beings, and it is systemic. It is the capitalist system that depends upon it. F. William Engdahl, in Bird Flu and Chicken Factory Farms, Profit Bonanza for U.S. Agribusiness, published on November 27th of last year, 2005, look to the giant chicken jails. The chicken factory farms around the world is the source of the emerging bird flu virus, not the small peasant chicken farmers. Donald Rumsfeld and the major stockholders of Gilead Science or Roche Inc., the marketers of the much-hyped Tamiflu, see my article, he writes, of is Tamiflu another Pentagon hoax, are reaping nice gains, but it's the agribusiness companies that reap the huge gains in the event that the scientists at Cambridge University and elsewhere are able to replace the entire world chicken population with genetically engineered chicks allegedly resistant to H5N1 virus. So what we are looking at here, as described by Engdahl, is an ancillary plot where agribusiness wants to destroy local peasant production of poultry, replace it with factory farms in which these the genetically engineered creatures, which will then be supposedly resistant to the H5N1 virus. And as they are writing these words, the virus is mutating. And indeed, the Wall Street Journal reports that the avian flu virus has split into two different forms already. This is the Wall Street Journal on March 21st. H5N1 virus, responsible for the global bird flu outbreak, has evolved into two genetically different strains. No sooner is the factory pharmaceutical company Nexus telling us that they need to have nothing but factory-produced birds to create a resistant strain when they've already induced a split strain with a new and even more virulent form of the bird flu. And so indeed, the article by Engdahl on bird flu and chicken factory farms, Profit Bonanza, relates it is the factory chicken farms, the huge, unsanitary, overcrowded factory chicken farms of the global agri-giants, which are the source and the incubator of H5N1 and other related disease. The major chicken factories, such as Tyson Foods, Purdue Farms, Conagra Poultry, making a propaganda campaign against chickens being allowed to be free and to roam into the open, and representing that their chickens are safer because they are raised in closed facilities, are disguising what these concentration camps for living creatures and birds and what the industrialization of chicken raising and slaughtering in the U.S., known as factory farming, is really about. The Chicken McNugget and Kentucky Fried Chicken dinner, supplied, by the way, by Tyson, are a concentration camps for living creatures. They never move. They are, as I mentioned, so crowded that their limbs are deformed. Their beaks are cut off because they peck each other to death. They're eating their own feces. And it is in these conditions that this flu virus has been engendered, and it is that which they are attempting to impose as the main... The main source of poultry.
As soon as the bird flu pandemic scare was spread throughout the world, in Vietnam, the government tried all production into factory farms. Purdue Farms, the U.S.'s fifth largest poultry producer, recently added a major chicken factory farm operation in China, and Tyson Foods, as far back as April 1997, entered an agreement with Kerry Holding Limited, a Hong Kong-based subsidiary of Kuok Group, to talk about locating agribusiness, 10 poultry complexes throughout China, which would process 5 million chickens each week. So this is going on as we speak.
Yes, Maya. One particular point in relation to this. Tyson runs 60 poultry processing plants engaged in slaughtering, cutting, packaging, and deboning 50 million chickens per week. Talk about mass murder. 30% of them are tainted with salmonella, 60% with the virulent Campylobacter, and indeed, it is the most dangerous item in the American home, according to Time magazine. And when the workers attempt to protest the treatment of these birds and the conditions, because Tyson gets rid of its workers, when they jump from 32 chickens a minute to 42, the workers protested. The company came right out and removed the workers. This is a war on living creatures. It is a war on species of the world. It is then a war against human beings themselves. For what? For the Pentagon to profit, for Rumsfeld and the pharmaceuticals to enrich themselves, for the White House and Mortimer Snerd to create the conditions for martial law, for the targeting of our people like others for mass pandemic, for profit, for control, and the preservation of a system that is worthy of the Nuremberg laws that were set forth to contain a Nazi regime re-emerged as corporate capitalism in America.
Those of you in New York will have an opportunity to hear Ralph this weekend. Please listen to the cart for the location. And also, this coming Tuesday for Taking Aim, we will have a live broadcast with Ralph in the WBAI studio, and we're asking you to telephone in. It's going to be a first for Taking Aim. Call in to WBAI, and we will respond to each and every question.
We want to discuss with you, brothers and sisters, the underlying politics of 9/11 and its relationship to the creation of the next pandemic. Let's have a real live exchange, brothers and sisters. Where do we go from here? What do we do to build a movement to resist?
This coming Tuesday, 5 o'clock. This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman.
Maya Schoen. Our program today is on our website archive, www.takingaim.info, and also on the WBAI archive, www.wbai.org. Filon dok ni wala ngane mandali wa
And you are tuned to listener-supported, commercial-free, community radio WBAI, WBAI.org, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. I was going to play the PSA for